I lose the heart to teach. When teachers lose heart. Many of us became teachers for reasons of the heart, animated by a passion for some subject and for helping people learn. But many of us lose heart as the years of teaching go by. How can we take heart in teaching once more so that we can, as good teachers always do, give heart to our students? We lose heart in part because teaching is a daily exercise in vulnerability. I need not reveal personal secrets to feel naked in front of a class. I need only parse a sentence or work a proof on the board while my students doze off or pass notes. No matter how technical my subject may be, the things I teach are things I care about, and what I care about helps define my selfhood. Unlike many professions, teaching is always done at the dangerous intersection of personal and public life. A good therapist must work in a personal way, but never publicly. The therapist who reveals as much as a client's name is derelict. A good trial lawyer must work in a public forum, but remain unswayed by personal opinion. The lawyer who allows private feelings about a client's guilt to weaken the client's defense is guilty of malpractice. But a good teacher must stand where personal and public meet, dealing with the thundering flow of traffic at an intersection where weaving a web of connectedness feels more like crossing a freeway on foot. As we try to connect ourselves and our subjects with our students, we make ourselves, as well as our subjects, vulnerable to indifference, judgment, ridicule. To reduce our vulnerability, we disconnect from students, from subjects, and even from ourselves. We build a wall between inner truth and outer performance, and we play-act the teacher's part. Our words, spoken at remove from our hearts, become the balloon speech in cartoons, and we become caricatures of ourselves. We distance ourselves from students and subject to minimize the danger, forgetting that distance makes life more dangerous still by isolating the self. This self-protective split of personhood from practice is encouraged by an academic culture that distrusts personal truth. Though the academy claims to value multiple modes of knowing, it honors only one, an objective way of knowing that takes us into the real world by taking us out of ourselves. In this culture, objective facts are regarded as pure, while subjective feelings are suspect and sullied. In this culture, the self is not a source to be tapped, but a danger to be suppressed, not a potential to be fulfilled, but an obstacle to be overcome. In this culture, the pathology of speech disconnected from self is regarded and rewarded as a virtue. If my sketch of the academic bias against selfhood seems overdone, here is a story from a class that I taught at a large university some years ago. I assigned my students a series of brief analytical essays involving themes in the texts we were going to be reading. Then I assigned a parallel set of autobiographical sketches related to those themes, so that my students could see connections between the textbook concepts and their own lives. After the first class, a student came up to me and inquired, "In those autobiographical essays you asked us to write, is it okay to use the word I?" I did not know whether to laugh or cry. But I knew that my response would have considerable impact on a young man who had just opened himself to ridicule. I told him that not only could he use the word I, but I hoped he would use it freely and often. Then I asked what had led to his question. "I'm a history major," he said, "and each time I use I in a paper, they knock off half a grade." The academic bias against subjectivity not only forces our students to write poorly, "it is believed" instead of "I believe," but also deforms their thinking about themselves and their world. In a single stroke, we delude our students into thinking that bad prose can turn opinions into facts, and we alienate them from their own inner lives. Faculty often complain that students have no regard for the gifts of insight and understanding that are the true payoff of education. They care only about short-term outcomes in the real world. Will this major get me a job? How will this assignment be useful in real life? But those are not the questions deep in our students' hearts. They are merely the questions they have been taught to ask, not only by tuition-paying parents who want their children to be employable, but also by an academic culture that distrusts and devalues inner reality. Of course our students are cynical about the inner outcomes of education. We teach them that the subjective life is unvalued and even unreal. Their cynicism simply proves that when academic culture dismisses inner truth and honors only the external world, students as well as teachers lose heart. How can we who teach reclaim our hearts for the sake of our students, ourselves, and educational reform? That simple question challenges the assumption that drives most reform, that meaningful change comes not from the human heart, but from factors external to ourselves, from budgets, methodologies, curricula, and institutional restructuring. Deeper still, it challenges the assumptions about reality and power that drive Western culture. The foundation of any culture lies in the way it answers the question, where do reality and power reside? For some cultures, the answer is the gods. For some, it is nature. For some, it is tradition. In our culture, the answer is clear. Reality and power reside in the external world of objects and events and in the sciences that study that world, while the inner realm of the heart is a romantic fantasy, an escape from harsh realities perhaps, but surely not a source of leverage over the real world. We are obsessed with manipulating externals because we believe that they will give us some power over reality and win us some freedom from its constraints. Mesmerized by a technology that seems to have done just that, we dismiss the inward world. We turn every question we face into an objective problem to be solved, and we believe that for every objective problem there is some sort of technical fix. That is why we train doctors to repair the body but not to honor the spirit, clergy to be CEOs but not spiritual guides, teachers to master techniques but not to engage their students' souls. Yet, at this point in history, it should be clear that external fixes will not come soon enough to sustain the deepest passions of people who care about teaching. Institutions reform slowly, and as long as we wait, depending on them to do the job for us, forgetting that institutions are also us, we merely postpone reform and continue the slow slide into cynicism that characterizes too many teaching careers. There is an alternative to waiting. We can reclaim our belief in the power of inwardness to transform our work and our lives. We became teachers because we once believed that ideas and insight are at least as real and powerful as the world that surrounds us. Now we must remind ourselves that inner reality can give us leverage in the realm of objects and events. We will find such a reminder in the testimony of Václav Havel, poet and man of practical affairs, a leader in the Velvet Revolution that liberated Czechoslovakia from Soviet rule. It was a revolution that succeeded in the face of obstacles considerably more daunting than those stacked against educational reform. Havel, now president of the Czech Republic, writes about spending years under a rock of institutional oppression that was dropped on the Czech people in the communist coup of 1968. Then he speaks of the inward seed of human consciousness and how it grew into a flower of reform that cracked and crumbled the granite of totalitarianism a mere 20 years later. The experience I'm talking about has given me one certainty. The salvation of this human world lies nowhere else than in the human heart, in the human power to reflect, in human meekness, and in human responsibility. Without a global revolution in human consciousness, nothing will change for the better, and the catastrophe toward which this world is headed will be unavoidable. Havel helped the Czech people reclaim their hearts by reminding them who they and all of us are. Not victims of external forces, but persons possessed of an inner power that cannot be taken from us, though we can and do give it away. Remembering ourselves and our power can lead to revolution, but it requires more than recalling a few facts. Remembering involves putting ourselves back together, recovering identity and integrity, reclaiming the wholeness of our lives. When we forget who we are, we do not merely drop some data. We dismember ourselves, with unhappy consequences for our politics, our work, our hearts. Academics often suffer the pain of dismemberment. On the surface, this is the pain of people who thought they were joining a community of scholars but find themselves in distant, competitive, and uncaring relationships with colleagues and students. Deeper down, this pain is more spiritual than sociological. It comes from being disconnected from our own truth, from the passions that took us into teaching, from the heart that is the source of all good work. If we have lost the heart to teach, how can we take heart again? How can we remember who we are for our own sake and the sake of those we serve? Mentors who evoked us. If identity and integrity are found at the intersection of the forces that converge in our lives, revisiting some of the convergences that called us toward teaching may allow us to reclaim the selfhood from which good teaching comes. In this section and the next, I want to reflect on two such encounters, with the mentors who evoked us and with the subjects of study that chose us. The power of our mentors is not necessarily in the models of good teaching they gave us, models that may turn out to have little to do with who we are as teachers. Their power is in the capacity to awaken a truth within us, a truth we can reclaim years later by recalling their impact on our lives. If we discovered a teacher's heart in ourselves by meeting a great teacher, recalling that meeting may help us take heart in teaching once more. In faculty workshops, I often ask people to introduce themselves by talking about a teacher who made a difference in their lives. As these stories are told, we are reminded of many facts about good teaching, that it comes in many forms, that the imprint of good teaching remains long after the facts they gave us have faded, and that it is important to thank our mentors, no matter how belatedly, partly because we owe them gratitude, and partly as a cosmic counterpoint to the apparent ingratitude of our own students. Then I ask the question that opens to the deeper purpose of this exercise. Not what made your mentor great, but what was it about you that allowed great mentoring to happen? Mentoring is a mutuality that requires more than meeting the right teacher. The teacher must meet the right student. In this encounter, not only are the qualities of the mentor revealed, but the qualities of the student are drawn out in a way that is equally revealing. One of my most memorable mentors was a man who seemed to break every rule of good teaching. He lectured at such length and with such enthusiasm that he left little room for questions and comments. Preoccupied with the world of thought, he listened poorly to students, not because he disdained them, but because he was so eager to teach them by the only way he knew, sharing his knowledge and passions. His classes were mostly monologues, and his students rarely played any role other than audience. He may sound like a pedagogical nightmare, but for reasons I could not articulate at the time, I was powerfully drawn to his teaching. Indeed, he changed my life. Only years later did I understand my attraction, and in that understanding are some clues to my identity. I was the first in my family to attend college. My family valued education, but it offered no exemplars of the intellectual life that has turned out to be my birthright gift. I kept that gift sealed in the box it came in all the way through high school, graduating somewhere below the median of my class with a major in extracurricular activities. Not until the second semester of college did I open the box, get excited about what was in it, and start doing well at schoolwork, going on to graduate school and into an academic career. My loquacious professor in college gave me a first glimpse into this part of myself. My excitement in listening to him lay less in what he said, though his ideas were exhilarating, than in discovering a dormant dimension of my identity. It did not matter to me that he violated most rules of good group process and even some rules of considerate personal relations. What mattered was that he generously opened the life of his mind to me, giving full voice to the gift of thought. Something in me knew that this gift was mine as well, though it was years before I could fully trust that knowledge. Long into my career, I harbored a secret sense that thinking and reading and writing, as much as I loved them, did not qualify as real work. I taught and wrote, but I justified myself by working as an administrator for various institutions and projects, work that was practical and thus worthy, like that done by honored members of my family. Only in my mid-40s was I finally able to claim the life of the mind as the mainstay of my vocation, to trust the calling of my soul, a trust that deepened when I was able to decode this early experience of being mentored. As we recall our mentors, not all of our self-insights are as happy as the one I have just drawn. We sometimes take the wrong lessons from the mentors who draw us when we are young and impressionable. I witnessed such a case at a faculty workshop I led a few years ago. My on-campus host had taken pains to warn me about Professor X, a curmudgeonly and unpopular teacher, though brilliant in his scholarly field. Of the 40 people in the workshop, my host said, Professor X had probably signed up not to learn about teaching, but to debunk what we were doing. In trepidation, I began the workshop with something soft, inviting people to introduce themselves by talking about their mentors. By the time we got to Professor X, 6 or 8 people had spoken, many with insight and feeling, and a spirit of openness filled the room. I tensed as he began to speak, fearing that this spirit was about to be killed. But it soon became clear that he, too, had been touched by the quality of the exchange. He told the story of his mentor with the hesitancy that comes from speaking of sacred things, and, as he talked about how hard he had tried to model his own career after his mentor's, he surprised us, and surely himself, by choking up. Later, in private conversation with him, I learned the reason for his emotions. For 20 years, Professor X had tried to imitate his mentor's way of teaching and being, and it had been a disaster. He and his mentor were very different people, and X's attempt to clone his mentor's style had distorted his own identity and integrity. He had lost himself in an identity not his own, a painful insight that took courage to embrace, but one with the promise of growth. Professor X's story gave me some insight into myself, an example of the mutual illumination that often occurs when we are willing to explore our inner dynamics with each other. Early in my career, I too had tried to emulate my mentor with non-stop lecturing, until I realized that my students were even less enthralled by my cheap imitation than some of my classmates had been by the genuine original. I began to look for a way to teach that was more integral to my own nature, a way that would have as much integrity for me as my mentors had for him. For the key to my mentor's power was the coherence between his method and himself. I began the long process of trying to understand my own nature as a teacher and to learn the techniques that might help it along. Though I need sometimes to lecture, and may even enjoy doing it, lecturing all the time simply bores me. I usually know what I am going to say, and I have heard it all before. But dialogical methods of teaching help keep me alive. Forced to listen, respond, and improvise, I am more likely to hear something unexpected and insightful from myself as well as others. That does not mean that lecturing is the wrong way to teach. It simply means that my identity, unlike my mentors, is more fulfilled in dialogue. When I was young and did not know who I was, I needed someone to model the intellectual gift that might be mine. But now, in midlife, knowing myself better, my identity demands that I use my gift in interaction and interdependence with others. Here, I believe, is the proper and powerful role of technique. As we learn more about who we are, we can learn techniques that reveal rather than conceal the personhood from which good teaching comes. We no longer need to use technique to mask the subjective self, as the culture of professionalism encourages us to do. Now we can use technique to manifest more fully the gift of self from which our best teaching comes. The self-knowledge that comes from these reflections is crucial to my teaching, for it reveals a complexity within me that is within my students as well. In my case, the I who teaches is both intimidated by and attracted to the life of the mind. For a long time, it was bedeviled by a sense that the intellectual work it felt called to do was nonetheless a fraud. This I, despite its intrigue with ideas, was once so unsure of itself that it welcomed a mentor whose performance barred participation. But today, this same I finds its own performance boring and needs to be nurtured in dialogue. When I forget my own inner multiplicity and my own long and continuing journey toward selfhood, my expectations of students become excessive and unreal. If I can remember the inner pluralism of my own soul and the slow pace of my own self-emergence, I will be better able to serve the pluralism among my students at the pace of their young lives. By remembering our mentors, we remember ourselves. And by remembering ourselves, we remember our students. Looking back, I realize that I was blessed with mentors at every crucial stage of my young life, at every point where my identity needed to grow, in adolescence, in college, in graduate school, and early in my professional career. But a funny thing happened on the way to full adulthood. The mentors stopped coming. For several years, I waited for the next one in vain, and for several years, my own growth was on hold. Then I realized what was happening. I was no longer an apprentice, so I no longer needed mentors. It was my turn to become a mentor to someone else. I needed to turn around and look for the new life emerging behind me, to offer to younger people the gift that had been given to me when I was young. As I did, my identity and integrity had new chances to evolve in each new encounter with my students' lives. Mentors and apprentices are partners in an ancient human dance, and one of teaching's great rewards is the daily chance it gives us to get back on the dance floor. It is the dance of the spiraling generations in which the old empower the young with their experience, and the young empower the old with new life, reweaving the fabric of the human community as they touch and turn. Subjects that chose us. Many of us were called to teach by encountering not only a mentor, but also a particular field of study. We were drawn to a body of knowledge because it shed light on our identity as well as on the world. We did not merely find a subject to teach, the subject also found us. We may recover the heart to teach by remembering how that subject evoked a sense of self that was only dormant in us before we encountered the subject's way of naming and framing life. Alice Kaplan is a teacher of French language and literature, and she has done this kind of remembering in a book called French Lessons. "Why do people want to adopt another culture?" she asks as she summarizes her journey into teaching and into life. "Because there's something in their own they don't like that doesn't name them." French culture gave Kaplan a way of claiming an identity and integrity she could not find in the culture to which she was born. Recalling a course she taught in which a bigoted young man learned to appreciate the stranger through encountering another people in another language, Kaplan reflects, "Moments like this make me think that speaking a foreign language is a chance for growth, for freedom, for liberation from the ugliness of our received ideas and mentalities." But Kaplan also understands the shadow side of a borrowed identity. "Learning French did me some harm by giving me a place to hide. If life got too messy, I could take off into my second world. But," she says, "writing about it has made me air my suspicions, my anger, my longings, to people for whom it's come as a total surprise." The self-knowledge she gained by asking why she was attracted to her field helped her reconnect, wrestle with, and even redeem troubling events and relationships in her life, renewing her teacher's heart. Reading Kaplan's reflections, richer by far in shadow and light than my brief review suggests, I was encouraged to make my own. My undergraduate majors were philosophy and sociology, and many of the details I once knew about those fields have long since leached away. But I still recall, 35 years later, the moment I discovered C. Wright Mills's idea of the sociological imagination. I was not merely taken with it, I was possessed by it. The essence of his idea is simple, but it was radical to me. We cannot see what is out there merely by looking around. Everything depends on the lenses through which we view the world. By putting on new lenses, we can see things that would otherwise remain invisible. Mills taught me how to view the world through the lenses of social theory, and when I took my first look, the world jumped out at me as if I had donned the 3D movie glasses that Hollywood was hawking at the time. I saw the invisible structures and secret signals that shape our social lives, that have a power over us that I thought resided only in face-to-face relationships. I was astonished at this new vision of life in which people walked about, not freely as I had imagined, but controlled by strings attached to their minds and hearts by invisible puppeteers. Why was I so deeply drawn to the idea of the sociological imagination? Why did it become such a defining feature of my worldview? By reflecting on those questions, I have remembered some key features of who I am. Intellectually, the idea of the sociological imagination spoke to me because at age 18, I had begun to understand that what you see is not necessarily what you get. I was a child of the 1950s, with its many social fictions, so it took time for me to see that the visible performance of individuals and groups was only the on-stage aspect of things, that reality has backstage dynamics far more influential than the performance we see up front. But my attraction to Mills's concept was more than intellectual. It helped me come to terms with some of my deepest personal fears. As a young person, I found the onstage world both seductive and intimidating. It was an arena of visibility where I wanted to perform and become known, but also an arena where my competence would be tested and surely found wanting. As I came to understand the backstage realities revealed by the sociological imagination, I was able to shake off some of my performance fears. By looking backstage and seeing how human, how klutzy, how ordinary the mechanics of performance really are, how unlike the glitz and glamour of onstage performance itself, I could ask myself, if they can do it, why not me? This backstage knowledge gave me the comfort of knowing that all heroes have feet of clay. It had the calming effect of the counsel given to nervous public speakers, "Imagine your audience naked." But my attraction to the sociological imagination went deeper still, beyond intellectual interest, beyond performance fears, to a gap within my own soul. Mills's distinction between the onstage show and backstage reality mirrored a great divide in my inner life. Outwardly, I had learned how to make my performance seem relatively smooth and accomplished, but inwardly, I felt anxious and fumbling and inept. The constant contradiction between how I experienced myself and how other people viewed me created a painful, sometimes crippling sense of fraudulence. But the sociological imagination and its view of societal duplicity helped me understand how common that contradiction is, how basic to the human condition, and my sense of fraudulence became less onerous. It has taken me a long time to turn Mills's insight from an analysis of our society toward an understanding of myself. The sociological imagination is easily used as one of those debunking tools, beloved of social science, that allows us to stand detached by the side of the road as the parade passes by, sniping at its silliness and pretending to be above it all. For a long time, I stood off to the side as critic and judge. And now I understand why. I was projecting onto society all the fraudulence I felt but could not face in myself, and I was using that projection as a way of evading my own dividedness. I no longer wanted to live that way, which is why I take pains in my writing to counterbalance the truth of the sociological imagination. Earlier in this chapter, I insisted that our inner world has a reality and a power that can keep us from being victims of circumstance and compel us to take responsibility for our own lives. In effect, I argued that the world of social structures and signals need not dictate our lives, that the sociological imagination that so entranced me as a young man and has its grip on me yet does not hold all the answers. In the very act of writing this chapter, I have been encountering my subject and myself anew, still respectful of the power of social facts, but unwilling to use that knowledge as an escape from personal responsibility. What I have learned about my identity as a teacher from this remembering is to some extent encouraging. I would not be an advocate of the power of inner reality if I had not reached some degree of congruence between my onstage and backstage lives. But I have also learned that my conflict between onstage and backstage reality is far from being resolved. It continues to come up in my teaching. That conflict was the theme of the teaching stories I told at the start of this chapter, stories whose drama, such as it is, lies in the tension between my external response to classroom events and my internal sense of incompetence. One of my favorite essays on teaching is Jane Tompkins's Pedagogy of the Distressed. It seems to have been written directly to my divided condition. With wonderful candor, Tompkins says that her obsession as a teacher had not been with helping students learn what they wanted and needed to know, but rather with A, showing the students how smart I was, B, showing them how knowledgeable I was, and C, showing them how well prepared I was for class. I had been putting on a performance whose true goal was not to help the students learn, but to act in such a way that they would have a good opinion of me. Then she asks, how did it come to be that our main goal as academicians turned out to be performance? Her answer rings true to me. Fear. Fear of being shown up for what you are, a fraud, stupid, ignorant, a clod, a dolt, a sap, a weakling, someone who can't cut the mustard. That is how it sometimes is for me. Driven by fear that my backstage ineptitude will be exposed, I strive to make my onstage performance slicker and smoother, and in the process make it less and less likely that my students will learn anything other than how to cover up and show off. I conceal my own heart, and am unable to weave the fabric of connectedness that teaching and learning require. Once again, when I seek my identity and integrity, what I find is not always a proud and shining thing. The discoveries I make about myself when I remember the encounters that have shaped and revealed my selfhood are sometimes embarrassing, but they are also real. Whatever the cost in embarrassment, I will know myself better and thus be a better teacher when I acknowledge the forces at play within me instead of allowing them to wreak witless havoc on my work. Florida Scott Maxwell, writing in her mid-80s, made the point powerfully. You need only claim the events of your life to make yourself yours. When you truly possess all you have been and done, you are fierce with reality. The teacher within. Encounters with mentors and subjects can awaken a sense of self and yield clues to who we are. But the call to teach does not come from external encounters alone. No outward teacher or teaching will have much effect until my soul assents. Any authentic call ultimately comes from the voice of the teacher within, the voice that invites me to honor the nature of my true self. By the voice of the inward teacher, I do not mean conscience or superego, moral arbiter or internalized judge. In fact, conscience, as it is commonly understood, can get us into deep vocational trouble. When we listen primarily for what we ought to be doing with our lives, we may find ourselves hounded by external expectations that can distort our identity and integrity. There is much that I ought to be doing by some abstract moral calculus, but is it my vocation? Am I gifted and called to do it? Is this particular ought a place of intersection between my inner self and the outer world, or is it someone else's image of how my life should look? When I follow only the oughts, I may find myself doing work that is ethically laudable, but not mine to do. A vocation that is not mine, no matter how externally valued, does violence to the self in the precise sense that it violates my identity and integrity on behalf of some abstract norm. When I violate myself, I invariably end up violating the people I work with. How many teachers inflict their own pain on their students? The pain that comes from doing what never was or no longer is their true work. In contrast to the strained and even violent concept of vocation as an ought, Frederick Buchner offers a more generous and humane image of vocation as the place where your deep gladness and the world's deep hunger meet. In a culture that sometimes equates work with suffering, it is revolutionary to suggest that the best inward sign of vocation is deep gladness. Revolutionary but true. If a work is mine to do, it will make me glad over the long haul, despite the difficult days. Even the difficult days will ultimately gladden me, because they pose the kinds of problems that can help me grow in a work if it is truly mine. If a work does not gladden me in these ways, I need to consider laying it down. When I devote myself to something that does not flow from my identity, that is not integral to my nature, I am most likely deepening the world's hunger rather than helping to alleviate it. There are times when we must work for money rather than meaning, and we may never have the luxury of quitting a job because it does not make us glad. But that does not release us from continually checking the violence we do to others and ourselves by working in ways that violate our souls. Nor does it relieve us from wondering whether preserving integrity is a luxury. What brings more security in the long run? Holding this job or honoring my soul? The teacher within is not the voice of conscience, but of identity and integrity. It speaks not of what ought to be, but of what is real for us, of what is true. It says things like, "This is what fits you, and this is what doesn't. This is who you are, and this is who you are not. This is what gives you life, and this is what kills your spirit, or makes you wish you were dead." The teacher within stands guard at the gate of selfhood, warding off whatever insults our integrity, and welcoming whatever affirms it. The voice of the inward teacher reminds me of my truth as I negotiate the force field of my life. I realize that the idea of a teacher within strikes some academics as a romantic fantasy, but I cannot fathom why. If there is no such reality in our lives, centuries of Western discourse about the aims of education become so much lip-flapping. In classical understanding, education is the attempt to lead out from within the self a core of wisdom that has the power to resist falsehood and live in the light of truth, not by external norms, but by reasoned and reflective self-determination. The inward teacher is the living core of our lives that is addressed and evoked by any education worthy of the name. Perhaps the idea is unpopular because it compels us to look at two of the most difficult truths about teaching. The first is that what we teach will never take unless it connects with the inward living core of our students' lives, with our students' inward teachers. We can and do make education an exclusively outward enterprise, forcing students to memorize and repeat facts without ever appealing to their inner truth, and we get predictable results. Many students never want to read a challenging book or think a creative thought once they get out of school. The kind of teaching that transforms people does not happen if the student's inward teacher is ignored. The second truth is even more daunting. We can speak to the teacher within our students only when we are on speaking terms with the teacher within ourselves. The student who said that her bad teachers spoke like cartoon characters was describing teachers who have grown deaf to their inner guide, who have so thoroughly separated inner truth from outer actions that they have lost touch with a sense of self. Deep speaks to deep, and when we have not sounded our own depths, we cannot sound the depths of our students' lives. How does one attend to the voice of the teacher within? I have no particular methods to suggest other than the familiar ones. Solitude and silence, meditative reading and walking in the woods, keeping a journal, finding a friend who will listen. I simply propose that we need to learn as many ways as we can of talking to ourselves. That phrase, of course, is one we normally use to name a symptom of mental imbalance, a clear sign of how our culture regards the idea of an inner voice. But people who learn to talk to themselves may soon delight in the discovery that the teacher within is the sanest conversation partner they have ever had. We need to find every possible way to listen to that voice and take its counsel seriously, not only for the sake of our work, but for the sake of our own health as well. If someone in the outer world is trying to tell us something important and we ignore his or her presence, the person either gives up and stops speaking or becomes more and more violent in attempting to get our attention. Similarly, if we do not respond to the voice of the inward teacher, it will either stop speaking or become violent. I am convinced that some forms of depression, of which I have personal experience, are induced by a long-ignored inner teacher trying desperately to get us to listen by threatening to destroy us. When we honor that voice with simple attention, It responds by speaking more gently and engaging us in a life-giving conversation of the soul. That conversation does not have to reach conclusions to be of value. We do not need to emerge from talking to ourselves with clear goals, objectives, and plans. Measuring the value of inner dialogue by its practical outcomes is like measuring the value of a friendship by the number of problems that are solved when friends get together. Conversation among friends has its own rewards. In the presence of our friends, we have the simple joy of feeling at ease, at home, trusted, and able to trust. We attend to the inner teacher not to get fixed, but to befriend the deeper self, to cultivate a sense of identity and integrity that allows us to feel at home wherever we are. Listening to the inner teacher also offers an answer to one of the most basic questions teachers face. How can I develop the authority to teach, the capacity to stand my ground in the midst of the complex forces of both the classroom and my own life? In a culture of technique, we often confuse authority with power, but the two are not the same. Power works from the outside in, but authority works from the inside out. We are mistaken when we seek authority outside ourselves, in sources ranging from the subtle skills of group process to that less than subtle method of social control called grading. This view of teaching turns the teacher into the cop on the corner, trying to keep things moving amicably and by consent, but always having recourse to the coercive power of the law. External tools of power have occasional utility in teaching, but they are no substitute for authority, the authority that comes from the teacher's inner life. The clue is in the word itself, which has author at its core. Authority is granted to people who are perceived as authoring their own words, their actions, their own lives, rather than playing a scripted role at great remove from their own hearts. When teachers depend on the coercive powers of law or technique, they have no authority at all. I am painfully aware of the times in my own teaching when I lose touch with my inner teacher and therefore with my own authority. In those times, I try to gain power by barricading myself behind the podium and my status while wielding the threat of grades. But when my teaching is authorized by the teacher within me, I need neither weapons nor armor to teach. Authority comes as I reclaim my identity and integrity, remembering my selfhood and my sense of vocation. Then teaching can come from the depths of my own truth, and the truth that is within my students has a chance to respond in kind. Chapter 2. A Culture of Fear. Education and the Disconnected Life. Day after day up there, beating my wings with all of the softness truth requires, I feel them shrug whenever I pause. They class my voice among tentative things, and they credit fact, force, battering. I dance my way toward the family of knowing, embracing stray error as a long-lost boy, and bringing him home with my fluttering. Every quick feather asserts a just claim. It bites like a saw into white pine. I communicate right, but explain to the dean, well, right has a long and intricate name. And the saying of it is a lonely thing. William Stafford, Lit Instructor. An Anatomy of Fear. If we want to develop and deepen the capacity for connectedness at the heart of good teaching, we must understand and resist the perverse but powerful draw of the disconnected life. How and why does academic culture discourage us from living connected lives? How and why does it encourage us to distance ourselves from our students and our subjects, to teach and learn at some remove from our own hearts? On the surface, the answer seems obvious. We are distanced by a grading system that separates teachers from students, by departments that fragment fields of knowledge, by competition that makes students and teachers alike wary of their peers, and by a bureaucracy that puts faculty and administration at odds. Educational institutions are full of divisive structures, of course, but blaming them for our brokenness perpetuates the myth that the outer world is more powerful than the inner. The external structures of education would not have the power to divide us as deeply as they do if they were not rooted in one of the most compelling features of our inner landscape, fear. If we withdrew our assent from these structures, they would collapse, an academic version of the Velvet Revolution. But we collaborate with them, fretting from time to time about their reform because they so successfully exploit our fear. Fear is what distances us from our colleagues, our students, our subjects, ourselves. Fear shuts down those experiments with truth that allow us to weave a wider web of connectedness, and thus shuts down our capacity to teach as well. From grade school on, education is a fearful enterprise. As a student, I was in too many classrooms riddled with fear, the fear that leads many children, born with a love of learning, to hate the idea of school. As a teacher, I am at my worst when fear takes the lead in me, whether that means teaching in fear of my students or manipulating their fears of me. Our relations as faculty colleagues are often diminished by fear. Fear is nearly universal in the relations of faculty and administration, and fear is a standard management tool in too many administrative kit bags. After 30 years of teaching, my own fear remains close at hand. It is there when I enter a classroom and feel the undertow into which I have jumped. It is there when I ask a question and my students keep a silence as stony as if I had asked them to betray their friends. It is there whenever it feels as if I have lost control. A mind-boggling question is asked, an irrational conflict emerges, or students get lost in my lectures because I myself am lost. When a class that has gone badly comes to a merciful end, I am fearful long after it is over, fearful that I am not just a bad teacher but a bad person, so closely is my sense of self tied to the work I do. My own fear is matched by the fear within my students. Though in my early years of teaching I conveniently forgot that fact. From where I stood, exposed and vulnerable at the front of the room, my students seemed enviously safe, hidden behind their notebooks, anonymous in the midst of the crowd. I should have remembered from my own experience that students, too, are afraid. Afraid of failing, of not understanding, of being drawn into issues they would rather avoid, of having their ignorance exposed or their prejudices challenged, of looking foolish in front of their peers. When my students' fears mix with mine, fear multiplies geometrically, and education is paralyzed. If we were to turn some of our externalized reformist energies toward exercising the inner demons of fear, we would take a vital step toward the renewal of teaching and learning. We would no longer need to put our lives on hold while waiting for structural change. By understanding our fear, we could overcome the structures of disconnection with the power of self-knowledge. What is the fear that keeps us beholden to those structures? Again, the answer seems obvious. It is the fear of losing my job or my image or my status if I do not pay homage to institutional powers. But that explanation does not go deep enough. We collaborate with the structures of separation because they promise to protect us against one of the deepest fears at the heart of being human, the fear of having a live encounter with alien otherness, whether the other is a student, a colleague, a subject, or a self-dissenting voice within. We fear encounters in which the other is free to be itself, to speak its own truth, to tell us what we may not wish to hear. We want those encounters on our own terms so that we can control their outcomes, so that they will not threaten our view of world and self. Academic institutions offer myriad ways to protect ourselves from the threat of a live encounter. To avoid a live encounter with teachers, students can hide behind their notebooks and their silence. To avoid a live encounter with students, teachers can hide behind their podiums, their credentials, their power. To avoid a live encounter with one another, faculty can hide behind their academic specialties. To avoid a live encounter with subjects of study, teachers and students alike can hide behind the pretense of objectivity. Students can say, "Don't ask me to think about this stuff, just give me the facts." And faculty can say, "Here are the facts, don't think about them, just get them straight." To avoid a live encounter with ourselves, we can learn the art of self-alienation, of living a divided life. This fear of the live encounter is actually a sequence of fears that begins in the fear of diversity. As long as we inhabit a universe made homogeneous by our refusal to admit otherness, we can maintain the illusion that we possess the truth about ourselves and the world. After all, there is no other to challenge us. But as soon as we admit pluralism, we are forced to admit that ours is not the only standpoint, the only experience, the only way, and the truths we have built our lives on begin to feel fragile. If we embrace diversity, we find ourselves on the doorstep of our next fear of the conflict that will ensue when divergent truths meet. Because academic culture knows only one form of conflict, the win-lose form called competition, we fear the live encounter as a contest from which one party emerges victorious while the other leaves defeated and ashamed. To evade public engagement over our dangerous differences, we privatize them, only to find them growing, larger, and more divisive. If we peel back our fear of conflict, we find a third layer of fear, the fear of losing identity. Many of us are so deeply identified with our ideas that when we have a competitive encounter, we risk losing more than the debate. We risk losing our sense of self. Of course, there are forms of conflict more creative than the win-lose form called competition, forms that are vital if the self is to grow. But academic culture knows little of these alternative forms, such as consensual decision-making, in which all can win and none need lose, in which winning means emerging from the encounter with a larger sense of self than one brought into it, in which we learn that the self is not a scrap of turf to be defended, but a capacity to be enlarged. If we embrace the promise of diversity, of creative conflict, and of losing in order to win, we still face one final fear. The fear that a live encounter with otherness will challenge or even compel us to change our lives. This is not paranoia. The world really is out to get us. Otherness, taken seriously, always invites transformation, calling us not only to new facts and theories and values, but also to new ways of living our lives. And that is the most daunting threat of all. Our multi-layered fear of the live encounter is not simply a personal emotion that teachers and students bring into the classroom one by one. It is also a cultural trait at work in every area of our common life. We practice a politics of fear in which candidates are elected by playing on voters' anxieties about race and class. We do business in an economy of fear where getting and spending are driven by consumer worries about keeping up with the neighbors. We subscribe to religions of fear that exploit our dread of death and damnation. In a culture where fear is the air we breathe, it is hard to see how deeply fearful our education is, let alone imagine another way to teach and learn. This chapter focuses on pathological fear, so it is important to remember that fear can also be healthy. Some fears can help us survive, even learn and grow, if we know how to decode them. My fear that I am teaching poorly may not be a sign of failure, but evidence that I care about my craft. My fear that a topic will explode in the classroom may be not a warning to flee from it, but a signal that the topic must be addressed. My fear of teaching at the dangerous intersection of the personal and the public may not be cowardice, but confirmation that I am taking the risks that good teaching requires. Fear can also play a positive role in students' lives. When Albert Camus writes, "What gives value to travel is fear," his words could easily apply to the forays that good teachers make with their students across landscapes of alien truth. Camus speaks of the fear we feel when we encounter something foreign and are challenged to enlarge our thinking, our identity, our lives. The fear that lets us know we are on the brink of real learning. It is the fact that at a certain moment when we are so far from our own country, we are seized by a vague fear and an instinctive desire to go back to the protection of old habits. At that moment we are feverish but also porous, so that the slightest touch makes us quiver to the depths of our being. we come across a cascade of light, and there is eternity. The fear that makes people porous to real learning is a healthy fear that enhances education, and we must find ways to encourage it. But first we must deal with the fear that makes us not porous but impervious, that shuts down our capacity for connectedness and destroys our ability to teach and learn. I want to examine three places where that shutdown occurs: in the lives of our students, in our own self-protective hearts, and in our dominant way of knowing. We will be freed from these pathologies neither by technique nor by structural reform, but rather by insight into how and why fear dominates our lives. The student from hell. The fear that shuts down the capacity for connectedness is often at work in our students. If we could see that fact clearly and consistently, and learn to address our students' fears rather than exploit them, we would move toward better teaching. But seeing is never simple, and the lenses through which many teachers view the young these days tend to distort who and how our students really are. When I ask teachers to name the biggest obstacle to good teaching, the answer I most often hear is my students. When I ask why this is so, I hear a litany of complaints. My students are silent, sullen, withdrawn. They have little capacity for conversation. They have short attention spans. They do not engage well with ideas. They cling to narrow notions of relevance and usefulness and dismiss the world of ideas. If my report seems exaggerated, here is the banner from a recent brochure announcing a national conference on teaching and learning. It's a fact. Many students have no direction and lack motivation. These students have little knowledge of the social skills necessary for teamwork and negotiation. They're bored and passive in situations calling for action, and belligerent and destructive in contexts requiring reflection. When I inquire about the causes of these alleged faults, I hear another standard litany, this time one of societal ills: absentee parents and the vanishing family, the deficiencies of public education, the banality of television and mass culture, the ravages of drugs and alcohol. All are held to blame for the diminished state of our students' minds and lives. As impressive as this list is, the ferocity with which some faculty insist that today's students are vastly inferior to those of their own generation makes one wonder whether social change alone can account for such dramatic decline. Perhaps the DNA itself has degenerated within the past quarter century. Whatever tidbits of truth these student stereotypes contain, they grossly distort reality, and they widen the disconnection between students and their teachers. Not only do these caricatures make our lives look noble in comparison to the barbaric young, but they also place the sources of our students' problems far upstream from the place where our lives converge with theirs. Criticizing the client is the conventional defense in any embattled profession, and these stereotypes conveniently relieve us of any responsibility for our students' problems or their resolution. Some years ago, I met the dean of an experimental college who was guiding that project into its second year on the campus of a major university. He had just come from a faculty meeting, and it was clear from his demeanor that things had not gone well. "What happened?" I asked. "The faculty spent most of the morning complaining about the quality of our students. They said that this program would never work if we did not recruit young people who were better prepared." "What did you tell them?" "I listened as long as I could," he said, "but they could not get off their blame-the-student shtick. Finally, I said that they sounded like doctors in a hospital saying, 'Don't send us any more sick people. We don't know what to do with them. Send us healthy patients so we can look like good doctors.'" His analogy helped me understand something crucial about teaching. The way we diagnose our students' condition will determine the kind of remedy we offer. But we teachers spend little time thinking with each other about the condition of our students, about the maladies for which our teaching is supposed to be the cure. We have nothing to compare with the grand rounds common in hospitals, where doctors, nurses, therapists, and other professionals collaborate in diagnosing a patient's need. Instead, we allow our treatment mode to be shaped by the thoughtless stereotypes of students that float freely in faculty culture. The dominant diagnosis, to put it bluntly, is that our patients are brain dead. Small wonder, then, that the dominant treatment is to drip data bits into our students' veins, wheeling their comatose forms from one information source to the next until the prescribed course of